The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
Hey, it's Sam Ekstrom, host of the Don't Dread the Spread podcast on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Myself, along with my partner in crime, Sam Verhulst, will guide you through the treacherous yet exhilarating world of sports betting. And we'll even branch out into politics and pop culture once in a while. Hey, you can bet on anything. Follow us on Twitter at Sam Sports Picks. Subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. It's Don't Dread the Spread. Turn your nickels into dimes.
Here for another episode of Midwest Swing, episode number 13. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. I'm joined, as always, by my producer and my maestro, Andy Carlson, at Andy Carlson Show on the Twitter machine. Andy, what's new in your world?
It's raining like cats and dogs, and it's whenever we get together, we just get really random, terrible weather, like the Snowmageddon of the South Metro last week.
My guest today is Baltimore Sports and Life's Chris Sturr. Their Twitter account is at Be More Sports Life. Chris, how are we doing?
Doing well, Brandon. Thanks for having me on. How you doing?
I'm good. I appreciate you coming on. You had reached out to me a few months ago about an opportunity to help you guys contribute on the website, and I've been very happy to have been doing that for the last few months. How did the website be, I guess, is my first question, and was that something that you created on your own, or did somebody else create? I know you're in charge, but what was the evolution of the site like?
Well, first, thanks is mine for joining the site. The contributions have been great. Really appreciated. The site is my creation. Basically, I was working office life, and I'd started a blog. And it was just kind of a cathartic outlet, doing some additional writing. When I left my last full-time position, had more time to write. We had some incremental success, added the message board, got named Baltimore's best blog. Brought on some other contributors, and we've been building up incrementally since.
When did you start the website?
2009, yeah, January 2009.
Great. And so you brought on actually a pretty impressive bunch of guys. I remember, I know Paul Sporer is one of them. I believe maybe Rob Parker is another. Am I missing anybody off the top of your head?
Not a Rob Parker.
Ryan Parker?
We have Reggie Yinger from, he had spent the last 5 years covering, working in the Orioles player development department. He's currently contributing also to Baseball Prospectus and 2080 Baseball. Also, Jonathan Bernhardt, he's previously been with Sports on Earth and The Guardian. That's on our baseball side. Also, a couple other guys there. And then also, as you see, we also cover the Baltimore Ravens and University of Maryland basketball and football. We have a couple other guys contributing to national sites for those teams as well.
Yeah, and Bob Harkins has been doing some stuff for you too as well. I know we've got a project in the works. I don't want to spill the beans if you're not ready to do that, but that's another name I think people would recognize as well.
Yeah, Bob Harkins, previously with NBC Sports and Hardball Talk. Also did some work with Time Warner. He's currently listed as our managing editor, and glad to go ahead and spill that out. You graciously agreed to do a podcast also with Bob Weekly, going to cover the Orioles plus MLB in general. Looking forward to that. That'll be kicking off in a few weeks, so we'll have some more news about that at our board.
That sounds great. Yeah, looking forward to that. So when it comes to you as far as your background, you know, where are you from? You know, how did you get into baseball, so to speak?
Yeah, I'm grew up here in Baltimore. Only really time out of the area was I spent a year in college down in Tampa. The reason I'd gone to school there is St. Leo. I was a sports management major. I wanted to get into the operational side of baseball, particularly in baseball operations, player development, or scouting. And enjoyed the time down there. It was just a little too expensive. Came back to Baltimore, went to school at Towson University here in suburban Baltimore. Again, a sports management major. Was working for the Orioles in a gopher capacity, doing box office, ballpark tours, et cetera. Full-time hours, making no money, just trying to get a foot in the door, trying to have the opportunity if if it's so open. Went to the winter meetings in Dallas, and around that time, I guess it was probably the 2000 winter meetings. That was when A-Rod first signed with Texas. But it didn't work out. Wound up taking, at some point, needed to be able to feed myself. Took a full-time job in it was an insurance industry. You get working office life, you get away from any real prospects of getting back into the game. So for me, once I had started the blog, it was kind of it was enjoyable for me to have that outlet and another thing to go write and experience the game again.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's a really interesting backstory. How did you get into baseball specifically, whether it was as a child or as an older youth?
I grew up and played high school baseball. I guess you could say that. Spent a lot of time on the bench, but
me too.
Growing up with the game, that was always that was a connection to my dad. If you could have nothing else to talk about, I could talk about baseball. I guess that's fairly cliche, but it was true for us as well.
What has been your experience being around the Orioles as long as you have? It's an organization that's successes are obviously a bit more distant than they are for some others. But what has been your experience rooting for and following the O's?
I like that phrasing, Brian. it's accurate. I'm 36, so I was born in 79. The Orioles went to the World Series that year. They went to the World Series in 83. Unfortunately, don't have much recollection of either. Six World Series in the franchise history, and certainly I've heard about it all the time growing up from my dad. It was a franchise, over 25-year run, basically starting from around 60 was as good as any in baseball. But what I've grown up with over the last three decades is just a lot of pain, and particularly in that run from 98 through 2011, they were just the most inept organization in baseball, where they consistently had broken legs and they were trying to use Band-Aids to fix them. It was just it was horrible. The last 4 years has been kind of a window of improvement. Definitely some things personally I've enjoyed as a fan. And now it's about, can you sustain that and never take a next step? There's still a multitude of things organizational-wise that are an issue.
How do you evaluate Buck Showalter as a manager? You mentioned the last few years, and that kind of coincides with when he took over. But have things been generally more positive with him riding the ship?
Yeah, this will be the fifth full season for Showalter and Dan Duquette, executive vice president or GM together. Manager evaluation is always tough. I think Showalter gets the most out of his roster. One of the things he excels at is the usage of his bullpen, particularly in the fact that if he gets somebody up, they enter the game, they don't have people up multiple times. He tries to avoid using pitchers on back-to-back games. There's not a lot of abuse there. And he does utilize the roster as a whole. One of the things that Duquette and Showalter have done well together is obviously it's a 25-man roster, but effectively they've used a 26 or 27-man roster the last few years. And what I mean by that is they've continuously rotated people in and out based off of available options so that there was additional depth in the bullpen and always a fresh arm available for use.
Yeah, and we talked about that on the bullpen side of things recently. How sustainable is a strategy like that when guys start running out of options? That was kind of the angle we took a couple weeks ago, where some of these guys just don't have options anymore, and then you can't really extend your roster the same way.
Yeah, that's definitely something to watch this year. It becomes a little bit tighter. The whole roster as a whole, they don't have quite as much flexibility as they've had the last few years, so I'm interested to see how that evolves over the year.
So let's look back at the 2015 season. Obviously not a postseason trip for Baltimore. They finished exactly 500, 81-81. Was the final result a disappointment for you and for people around the team?
I think it has to be, just going off of the fact that the year before you had won the division for the first time since 97, you had gone to the playoffs for the second time in, well, in 14, the second time in 3 years. So you entered 15 with a lot of the same components, and you were looking for a similar type of run, but yeah, I don't think it was overly surprising. It was, I look at teams who enter a year, we're entering another season, and they have, you know, ranges of where they could fall. And the second half of 14, the Orioles had the rotation put up numbers that were not sustainable, and you would have thought there would have been some regression there. It just wound up that there was a ton, and it hit it once. And you had also lost Nelson Cruz's production, and they weren't able to get past that.
Yeah, I was just looking back. I mean, a 15-game decrease is pretty serious, but at the same time, too, you know, there were some positive signs in 2015. The first one I want to talk about, Manny Machado broke out in a huge way in his age 22 season. Just how great was he last year? I mean, if for someone who may not have watched him frequently last year, how would you explain his greatness to a casual observer?
Well, he gets lost in, obviously, when you start talking about a Trout or a Harper, but he is right there behind him. And for me, he's one of the top 10 overall players in the game. Arriondo in Colorado, I don't see enough of him, but obviously he's regarded as a superior defensive player as well, and he puts up gaudy offensive numbers out there in Colorado. But for me, and seeing Machado every day, it's hard to believe anybody's a better defensive third baseman than him. He's got incredible range, incredible arm and accuracy. He also has power to all fields. His ability to really take balls on the outer half and take them to right for extra base power is something that really bodes well for him. And the other thing is, I don't think we've seen his ceiling yet. I think there's more there. We've been talking at our site for some time what it's going to take to potentially lock him up into his past arbitration years. Or if we're just going to see the next 3 years of him in Baltimore and then see him winding up as a free agent going elsewhere, I'm going to enjoy him as long as he's here. He's just one of the absolute best players in the game.
Is the book closed on him playing shortstop in the future? I know there's kind of a straw man in his way in the form of J.J. Hardy, a former Minnesota Twin there right now, who's got the big contract, but it's kind of underperforming. But do you sense that Machado could move back to short? Obviously, he's not too old to do so.
If Hardy didn't exist, I think Machado could slide over today, and I'm sure he would be at least adequate at the position. I don't know if he would be the... would have quite the value that he has right now at third defensively, but I'm sure he would be, it's hard for me to believe he wouldn't be at least adequate. As far as whether he will or not, the longer he's at third, the less likely I think it becomes.
Yeah, that makes sense. So he was obviously a big part of an offense last year that I think was like third in the American League in home runs, but despite having lots of power, they still didn't score runs as you know, commensurate to the number of home runs they hit. What was the issue there?
Well, the Orioles have profiled very similarly for the last 4 years since 2012, where they've had a ton of power and mediocre to below average on base skills. They just don't get enough people on base. And if you look at the complexion of the roster this year, I don't think that's going to change. Yeah, it's going to be more power. It's going to be they're going to probably finish somewhere 15 to 20th overall in on base percentage. So they'll put up their share of runs, and there'll be plenty of nights where it looks anemic when they just the ball isn't going out of the park and they don't have anybody on.
And that's kind of a troubling thing to pair with this starting rotation, wouldn't you say? Or at least it can
be. The rotation is, again, I'll use a horrible cliche. The rotation is what it is. It just, you know, there's not a lot of ceiling there, and the ceiling that exists is Galdsman, and as you recently profiled him for the site. But to me, again, I look at the roster, and I see a team that looks very similar to the last 4 years where they finished above 500 in each of those years. So I think it's certainly plausible that they do again. I don't think they look much different to me. It's a team that has a lot of power, mediocre on-base skills. They need innings from their starters. They have the components for a strong bullpen, and the defense the last 4 years has been excellent, and I think it should be again.
Do you catch yourself wishing for a lot more from Kevin Gausman, and do you see that from other people, you know, in your position as a fan / you know, blogger that
sure.
you know everyone
yeah,
wishes
I
more
mean,
from him?
We're all, as Oriole fans, we're all hoping that Gausman takes the leap this year. It's a requirement really for this team to reach their ceiling. Gausman has to take a next step and be the and live up to the potential of his arm. I'm not really down on his progress so far. I mean, the guy is just turning 25. He's been kind of yo-yoed a bit by the Orioles back and forth. I'm looking forward to him. If this current bout of shoulder tendonitis is not the biggest deal, I'm looking forward to him taking the ball every fifth day and progressing, you know, month to month and seeing, you know, having the opportunity to stay in the majors over a full season and see what you have. You did, you know, that profile you did was pretty extensive. The one thing that a lot of us have keyed on is that it's the need for him to have that third pitch. He's got the power arm, but it's the fastball command. Everything's hard. He needs something, another off-speed offering. He's been talking about utilizing his curve that he used in college more this season, and we'll see. That potential certainly there. I think his floor, you know, I'm not worried about his floor at all. It's just how can he approach his ceiling this year.
So if you look at last year's numbers, there's five relievers who pitched at least 30 innings and struck out double-digit batters per nine innings. If I'm not mistaken, all five are still in the organization. What is the level of excitement for this bullpen? I know not a lot of people are going to compare them to the Yankees or the Royals with or without Greg Holland, but this has to be considered an asset as a unit before you consider the chess game that Showalter plays with those guys, don't you think?
I love the potential of the bullpen. It's definitely one of the strengths of the team. You know, obviously relievers can be volatile year to year, and they're also dependent in large parts to the rotation in front of them and what you're getting there, at least in terms of consistency of innings. But the Orioles bullpen does have the potential to be excellent. Britton and O'Day are monsters at the back end. O'Day, you know, as a sidearm setup guy, he's not often recognized for the talent he is, but you look at his K rates, he's just excellent, and every year he's been healthy, he's produced. Britton, with the exceptional ground ball percentage off his sinker, and Brock has been very solid, and then this year we're looking at the addition of Michael Givens and right now Dylan Bundy, so two real high quality arms also added to the bullpen there, which potential there to be a lockdown staff. Now it doesn't have the three elite guys of the Yankees, and Dylan Bundy hasn't proved himself to be Wade Davis yet for Kansas City, but if the Orioles rotation does give innings in front of them, then the Orioles bullpen has a chance to be as good as anybody.
What is intriguing about Michael Givens? You look at his numbers, and he's got more strikeouts than O'Day per nine innings and fewer walks, a 1.73 FIP, a 1.80 ERA. 30 innings, obviously not a huge sample size, but 38 strikeouts, 6 walks. That looks like a guy who could be the real deal. Is that smoke and mirrors, or does he have a big-time arm?
It's a high-quality arm. When he was drafted, both teams were looking at him as a pitcher. The Orioles drafted him as a position player. He was a middling shortstop in the system for a couple of years before being converted. And then he's had the fairly I don't want to say a meteoric rise, but you know, it doesn't take a lot to go from being getting a few innings at the double A level to going up and being somebody that can contribute an inning at a time at the majors when you have that quality of arm. In some ways, he looks somewhat similar to O'Day. Again, at the site, and we mentioned Reggie Inger previously, and his having worked in the player development department for the last 5 years of the Orioles, he did a nice profile on Givens. And I know you had mentioned that Paul Spohr is also at the site. He's also been pretty high on his potential there. Looking at the arm, it just jumps out at you, and the fact that he right now can just kind of slot in and doesn't have to be the man in the staff. You figure he's going to start the year not getting the highest leverage, just opportunities. It should be a nice opportunity for him to really get his feet wet and have a chance to perform.
How have your expectations for Dylan Bundy evolved over the years?
So when the Orioles, after that 98-11 spell, and they had, which locally was a fairly magical year in 2012, where they won a lot of games with one-run games. And, you know, that team played over the head, but they made the playoffs, and it was after that brutal stretch, it was certainly a welcome time. Bundy had pitched, had made the Orioles at the end of that year. He had had a dominating minor league season, was one of the top prospects in the game. Certainly the thought was, well, by the 13, he's going to have a chance to be part of the Orioles rotation. Didn't work out. And so in 12, he had about 105 combined innings at all the major league and minor league levels. In 13, he wound up missing the entire season. 14, he had about 40 combined innings in the minors. Last year, he had about 20-some combined innings. So right now, just hearing that Bundy looked healthy and his stuff is back, that's exciting. I think any talk about him joining a rotation, and I keep seeing that popping up in national articles, is I just don't really get it. To me, the absolute max amount of innings you could expect from him this year is roughly 75, so I just don't see how he can contribute to the rotation except maybe at the very end of the season if he hasn't breached that threshold. But if for this year he can stay healthy, stay on the mound, and he can help the Orioles bullpen, I'll take that. Certainly would have rather had the guy had the normal trajectory expected trajectory that he was going to have and be leading the Orioles rotation at this point. But I guess after the last 3 years, I'm just excited to see that he appears to be healthy.
Yeah, and I think if you talk about 75 innings and using him late in the season, that becomes a paradox that you can't have him really stretched out to start without having used up those innings by that point either. So to have him as a key cog of a very strong bullpen, I think that's playing with house money at this point. Another name that keeps popping up in the bullpen in projections is something some guy that I wrote about recently, Oliver Drake. Is he another big arm, or is that kind of one of those guys that's more smoke and mirrors? Because I know what my profile said, and I just wonder what you think about it.
You surprised me a little bit in that profile. You mentioned he had hit 95 in the previous day against the Twins, and that was something that I hadn't quite seen from him when he came up last year. He had the big splitter, and he's had some success. To me, I compared him to Brad Brock. He's somebody that kind of goes unnoticed in the Orioles bullpen that's had success the last couple of years, but he wouldn't be somebody that I would be expecting to contribute. But if he could certainly be an option at some point this year, and the fact that he's under team control and doesn't cost anything, that can make him valuable.
Who was the most surprising player on the 2015 team in your mind, whether it was a good surprise or a bad surprise?
That's a good question.
One guy that sticks out to me is Eubaldo Jimenez had a fairly decent year. I think Electable wanted to bury him for that contract. You know, he signed the same deal that I think Ricky Nolasco and Matt Garza did, and neither of those two guys have made good on their part. You know, I felt like Jimenez was solid last year. Obviously, you know, he's not going to be an ace
Jimenez,
or anything.
The Orioles obtained him prior to the 14th season. 14 was horrific, and he's somebody that's always struggled with maintaining his mechanics, and he was. But even for him, his walk percentage was much higher than his career averages in 14. In 15, he simplified his mechanics, and his walk percentage was below his career norms. I don't know if that's sustainable or not. Maybe it is with the simplified mechanics, but he certainly, if you look just in the as a fourth starter, this is a guy that's pretty consistently given teams about 180. 30 starts, and that has value. And it definitely was some surprise locally and nationally after, after 14, just how poor a season that was. So, yeah, he's a good candidate for that.
Perfect. Well, let's do this. We're gonna break down the 2016 preview, but let me read a couple things here first. If you like Cold Omaha and would like to support us, you can do that as simply as shopping at Amazon. Go to coldomaha.com/Amazon, and it will redirect you right to Amazon's front page. That doesn't matter if you use Amazon Prime, Amazon Pantry. I know my guy Andy is an Amazon Pantry guy, but if you bookmark that and use it every time you shop at Amazon, we get a little taste. It's the easiest way to support Cold Omaha. You could also go to the website, click on the banner, and do the same thing. We'd be happy to have you on the website. That's coldomaha.com. Launched in the last month. A lot of great content going up, whether it's Vikings draft talk with Luke Inman, Timberwolves for the recently streaking Wolves, or catching the Wild on their playoff run, or a little bit of Twins talk as the season's getting ready to get started here. But if you go to coldomaha.com/Amazon, again, you can support us. Another way you can support us is Ticket King. Go to ticketkingonline.com. And they have a deal with us this month. If you use the promo code COLD, like Cold Omaha, at checkout, you can save $10 off a purchase of $100 or more. So if you're going to catch some Timberwolves action, the Wild playing, or even concerts and show tickets, go to Ticket King Online, promo code COLD, and save $10 on a purchase over $100 or more. All these ticket fees, Ticket King, zero fees, unlike the big ticket guys. That's the best thing they got going for them today. One more time, ticketkingonline.com, promo code COLD. All right, Chris, so on to the 2016 season. Obviously, there's projections out for both Fangraphs and Baseball Prospectus. Fangraphs, last I checked, which was yesterday, said 79 and 83, Baseball Prospectus 75 and 87. Do you feel like those are a little bit pessimistic, or is that about what you expect for this team going forward?
I think it's slightly pessimistic, but I think it's within reason. When I look at the Pecota projections, and I also saw in the last few days, we saw Keith Law, ESPN's Keith Law, say the Orioles were the only team in the East that couldn't contend, and Jay Joffe at Sports Illustrated, he had the Orioles at 69 wins. I mean, I think that's a little overblown. To me, the Orioles' range at the low end, to me, is about 78 wins, and I think up to 90 is possible. I'm projecting them right now at about 80. I said yesterday somewhere between 81 and 85 wins. I said I would match you. Earlier this offseason, you participated in a survey at the site. We reached out to 30 writers and analysts across the game. Half of the people surveyed, 15, had the Orioles winning under 81 games, and 40% had them winning between 81 and 85. I would be in that range.
Yeah, I think that, you know, obviously within the error bar, too, of these surveys, there's potential, or not surveys, sorry, projections. You know, there's a chance to over and underachieve on them. And it is also worth noting, too, that Fangraphs has three teams winning fewer than 80 games. And the funny thing is all three of those won at least 80 games last year. That's the Minnesota Twins, the Kansas City Royals, and the Baltimore Orioles.
And no team has more than 88 wins. That's the Boston Red Sox, who they have leading the American League East. So it's a pretty jumbled up, kind of convoluted mess in the American League. And I think that also works to the advantage of teams like the Twins here, the Orioles for you, in that, you know, no team is really going to distance themselves talent-wise. Now, maybe somebody goes on a crazy hot run to start the season. But, it seems to me, and you can feel free to disagree if you wish, that every team in the American League has a chance at competing this year.
Yeah, a couple points there. And you can speak better to the Twins than I, obviously, but at least with the Orioles and Royals, you have two teams there that are in large part built their bullpen and defense, and those are two areas that I don't think some of the projections really account for that strongly. To your second point about the American League, pretty much everybody fancies himself as at least having a chance at competing for one of the wild card positions, unlike the National League, where you have a handful of legitimate contenders and then a bunch of teams that are clearly rebuilding. So, the division races will be interesting, the wild card races will be interesting, and then you also have to look and see who is playing who in the International League, and that might benefit somebody in the American League in the wild card race.
Now, everyone says the bullpen's going to be amazing. Is this going to be, in your estimation, a five-and-dive starting rotation where you just get through five innings and you can hand it off to the bullpen and they can kind of take care of the rest?
You can look at the guys individually. You mentioned Menez. We spoke a little bit about Gausman. You need Gausman to take that next step. Behind him, you're looking at Tillman. You need Tillman to kind of rebound to what he was during 2012 for 2014, and really overall what he was against everybody not named Toronto last year. His numbers were, Toronto just crushed him all year and then really inflated his numbers. But for the most part, what you need out of Tillman is to be a 200-inning, 32-start starter. And then you're looking, at Gallardo, somebody that we weren't really excited about his addition at the site, but it's somebody that's had seven straight years of 30 starts and 180 innings, and you're looking for him to extend that another year, even if you expect, by looking at his peripherals, you expect regression and you expect his ERA to look more like his xFIP than his actual ERA last year.
Now, are you expecting anything even remotely useful from Gallardo? I know, you'll get people that are really deep into the stats that'll look at his velocity declining, strikeout rate declining, but at the same time, he still managed pretty decent results. Are you a little worried about him moving over from the National League to the American League? What's your full bore expectations for Giovanni Gallardo moving forward from this point?
Well, he was in the AL last year, but
I'm sorry. I forgot about the Rangers. That's right. I forgot that he was traded over from Milwaukee and spent a year with Texas.
His numbers across the board are going to go up. It's really, can he provide? To me, the only numbers I really care about with Gallardo this year are, can he again make 30 starts and give you 180 innings? I'm expecting an ERA of, 4.3 to 4.5. He's going to give up a ton of homers. His K rate's going to be probably continue to go down. You can look at his velocity, which is on a downward trend. There aren't a lot of reasons, if you look at his peripheral numbers, to have a lot of real excitement there. But if he can, for the most part, take the ball every fifth day and give the Orioles a chance to turn it over to their bullpen, that's what he's there for. So it's hard to be excited about that, but it's also, I guess on the positive side of him is I have slightly less fear in the Orioles rotation flaming out with him being there, and also not just his consistency and durability, but the fact that he knocks down the other guys, the depth of the rotation, the 6 through 9 guys like Despain and Worley and Mike Wright and Tyler Wilson, he knocks them all down a peg where you are, if you have to use them, you have that additional depth.
So switching gears just a little bit to the offense, what is going on with the Hyun-Soo Kim situation? That seems to be kind of an interesting hot button debate going on about if the Orioles gave him a fair crack to make this lineup, or you know what in the world's going on.
Yeah, Twins fans can identify with that looking at the KBO and trying to translate the numbers and and have an expectation level this year. You know, Kim was signed, and we've talked about the Orioles on-base struggles. That was something that he excelled at in the KBO, and I've looked at that as kind of a double-A equivalent. And my expectation for Kim, if he had had a full season of at-bats this year, was something around a 750 OPS. And despite his gold gloves in career, we were told that this guy has a below-average arm and mediocre range. I wasn't expecting much from him defensively, but was expecting him to kind of hold his own, at least offensively, and provide some value there. He really struggled at the start of camp. Defensive issues were kind of exacerbated, and then he had I believe he had an over for 23 spell to start things off offensively. So didn't make a great first impression. He had the opportunity, it looks like, if they wanted to send him to the minors, he has to okay that. It appears that he's going to accept that and go to AAA to start the year, which I think benefits him and the Orioles. It looks like he's going to DH for AAA Norfolk, which is kind of interesting to me. You'd like to at least see him some in the outfield. But obviously, it's a huge transition, not just against better competition, better starters, higher velocity, but specialty relievers, but also culturally, and a longer season, additional travel. I mean, there's a million different things at play there, so I kind of like the idea that he can go to AAA, kind of get a little bit comfortable, and we'll see what he can do offensively. You know, those 4,000 at-bats that he had in Korea do account for something, but, let's see what he can do against some better competition.
So is the primary benefactor in terms of playing time of this, is it Joey Ricard?
It is. He's the Orioles' Rule 5 pick this past year, and he, as big an impression as you can make in the limited spring training time, you try not to get read too much into that, he's the benefactor. This is a guy that doesn't have much playing time above the double-A level, but his minor league profile looks like he has some on-base skills. He certainly has some athleticism, some speed, and some he's going to help defensively. So he's going to help in that capacity, and we'll see how well the bat plays. I'm not going to read too much into the sample size of spring training, so I'm interested to get a better look at him. And then even if he gets off to a positive start, you're going to have to look and see how the league adjusts and how he adjusts back.
So when you look at the month of April, who do you suspect is going to be the largely starting outfield from left to right?
So it will be Rickard in left, Adam Jones in center, and it will be Trumbo in right. Trumbo, and you and I have discussed this some. I became okay with the idea of Trumbo in right, thinking that Kim was going to be in left and that Ricard would be available as a defensive replacement for close and late situations. Now, with Ricard as the starting left fielder, I am, again, I'm finding myself again irritated to have Trumbo in right, where if you look at his defensive statistics, if you look at his zone rating and you look at the defensive run save, this is a guy that really struggled in the outfield, but over a considerable amount of innings, roughly 3,000 innings, has been regarded as a plus first baseman. So the logical fit to me would be Chris Davis moving out to right, where Davis does have plus athleticism and a strong arm. I think he could be at least an average right fielder, and Trumbo at first, but at least to start the year, they're gonna run with Davis at first and Trumbo in right.
Do you have any inside scoop as to why they don't want Davis out there? I mean, are they protecting their investment, or is it a comfortability thing, or is there something else going on here?
I don't have any inside factor. It's been suggested that maybe there was a wink and a nod when Davis signed his deal that he wouldn't be moved around. To me, that was part of the attraction for extending Davis was signing him at that point was that he did have some position versatility and that you could use there. You know, I guess I buy into the idea that, you know, there is more running and there is an additional health factor of being out in the outfield, but that seems a little overblown to me. I don't know.
No, I agree. I think that it, you know, he probably did have some kind of assurance that they weren't going to have him play out there. Maybe there is something to the idea that he doesn't, you know, want to. Maybe there's just some other reason that we're not accounting for because we don't quite have that inside intel. The one thing I do want to ask about him specifically is, you know, how much do you love the idea of him and Trumbo and Pedro Alvarez in the same lineup power wise? Now, when I was looking at this offseason about a month ago, or maybe 2 months ago, and Austin Jackson was still out there, Alvarez wasn't even getting so much as a sniff on the free agent market. You know, it was kind of down to, you know, which guy makes more sense. Alvarez is going to give you the more obvious value offensively. Jackson could play right field and save you defensively. You know, they obviously went the route they did, and it was cheaper, and they're going to have a lot more thunder. Do you think they went the right route, and do you love the idea of having that much power in the lineup?
Well, obviously they tried to obtain Fowler, and that didn't enough.
Right, that was another thing. Yeah, we'll talk about physicals too.
But you know, the interesting thing for me when it was a decision of Alvarez, and that was I wrote about that as well, about the idea that the Orioles should be looking at him, that he should be an option, for DH. And again, I was suggesting the idea of Davis to right. I like the addition of Alvarez. If he's not going to play any defense, I like the additional power. And part of the reason I like that was your colleague at Fangraphs, Dave Cameron. He wrote an article last year, kind of incidentally about Trumbo, and he was talking about teams that have mediocre on base skills that they might be better served instead of trying to address the on-base issues by adding one player that could incrementally improve the on-base, that they would be better off addressing their strength and adding to their strength with power. So, based off of that logic, to me it made sense. Now, there's going to be plenty of games where the Orioles, you know, we talked about where they don't get anybody on, they aren't homering, and they'll look anemic at times, but the power is going to be immense. It's a team that I think they've hit 200 homers plus the last 4 years, and they should be able to challenge the 1996 Orioles for the franchise record for homers in a season.
It's going to be interesting to see how Alvarez handles not playing defense, you know, for the first time in his career, obviously coming over from the National League. But do you expect big things out of him, you know, especially because the cost to acquire him was so low? Are you expecting on a high return of investment for the Orioles on Alvarez this year?
Yeah, I'm interested to watch. I mean, if you look at his F WAR, and then you see just how bad the defense was. I mean, I'm wondering if he winds up being a two and a half win player just with taking out the defense from the equation.
Yeah, I think that's accurate too. You know, it's always fun to see when, you know, bad defenders get taken out of that element. And obviously there's certain adjustments to the formula that will penalize him as a DH too. But if you can isolate the offense that he provides and just look at it through that lens, I think you've got potential for him to be a very nice find for them. It kind of fell into their lap in that not many teams besides expressed interest that we know of publicly, but I think it's a good fit. As far as, you know, another guy in that lineup too, is J.J. Hardy just completely dead as far as offense? I mean, his numbers have slumped badly the last couple of years, or is there something else going on there that we don't know about here in flyover country?
So if you look at last year, if you look at it just his offensive numbers, they were just horrific. But this is a guy that he was dealing with a labrum issue. He also appeared to have back trouble. He had no ability to turn on a ball last year. And, you know, J.J. Hardy in his prime, low on base, power, plus his defense. We'll get to that in a second. But offensively, just, you know, he's going to make his living as a slugging shortstop, again, offensively. But, you know, with no ability to turn on the ball last year, it was just, it was brutal. He was also limited to 114 games this year at spring training. He's in that Florida sun. Says he feels good. He's I think he's up to 3 or 4 spring training home runs. Again, not trying to read too much into that. But if he is healthy, I expect he'll get closer to his career averages and closer, at least I think 2014, his numbers there, slightly under 700 OPS. I think that's closer to the player Hardy remains than what we saw from him last year. Defensively, amazingly, he retained his, you know, whatever issues he was dealing with back and shoulder-wise, they didn't affect him in the field. He was still elite last year. And getting him to play more than 114 games this year, that's a key, especially for a starting rotation that's high ground ball percentages. You need that anchor in the middle of the diamond.
So let's talk about his double play partner, Jonathan Scope. Do you have high hopes for Scope? And I realize that's a cheesy rhyming pun, but obviously derailed a bit by injuries last year. I know that as somebody who had him in score sheet, fantasy league, but he's a prospect that I've been kind of keeping my eyes on for the last couple of years. And, you know, you talk about a lot of the offense on this team, and I think he kind of falls by the wayside a little bit. Do you, again, not an on-base guy, which kind of fits the mold as well. Do you have high hopes for him?
I do, and he's one of the more interesting players on the team, in especially the fact of a system that's devoid of, you know, much talent, especially positional talent. He's somebody that the Orioles need to hit on and that can be a cornerstone piece going forward. He's got exceptional bat speed. He's had, you know, in his first two major league campaigns, you've seen a guy that has trouble with pitch recognition. He hunts fastballs early in the count. You can see he's visibly uncomfortable when he's down in the count, so he's looking to do damage early in the count. He's not taking a lot of pitches, but ball just explodes off his bat in the field. Growing as he came up, he was you know, a lot of the scouting reports were that he wasn't going to be able to stay at second. He was too big for the position. He was going to have to move. I've seen a guy that has better than advertised range. Not great, but better. He's very strong around the bag, and only maybe Cano has an arm that's his equal at second. So he's a better than advertised defensive second baseman. And offensively, if you look at his minor league profile, he was always kind of young for his level. His walk rates weren't overly strong, but they've been better than what they were at the major league level. I think there's some reason to expect that in year three there should be some jump there. And, you know, again, it does, and you mentioned it, and it's true. He's just another one, another Oriole with power and low on base percentage, but it wouldn't surprise me if he, you know, 30 home runs is within reach for Scope over a full season.
So you mentioned his arm. Would a possible future situation arise where you could see Machado moving to short and Scope playing third if Scope's defense range-wise deteriorates, or do you think it's second base or bust for him with the O's?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's within reason to think that if Hardy did have a full-on collapse, this year where the offense didn't rebound and defensively he goes from being elite to, you know, either not able to stay on the field or just no longer productive, and the Orioles decided internally that they would be better off with moving Machado to short, then Scope moving to third would be possible. But, Yeah, and similar to what we said with Machado, I think the longer that he stays at second, the more likely it is that he becomes entrenched there.
Okay, so we haven't talked about Matt Wieters, who's, you know, one of the more longer tenured players on the team. How stunned were you that he took the qualifying offer when the Orioles offered it?
I was surprised. I wasn't shocked. It was discussed on the board at our message board at our site for some time last summer that he could be the first player to accept the qualifying offer. You know, he wasn't playing every day when he returned. Showalter was basically starting him every other day behind the plate. He clearly still had there were some issues with his elbow even after he returned. I was surprised because as we entered the winter, we were seeing reports and suggestions from sites like MLB Trade Rumors that there were going to be multiple teams out there willing to give him a four-year deal. So with the thought that somebody would be giving him a four-year deal, you think it would be a fairly logical decision to turn down the offer. But obviously those offers didn't come for him. So I imagine it became a fairly easy decision for him to accept.
So one thing we had talked about, you mentioned how good the defense had been in previous years. Do you suspect that's going to take a step back this year? Or do you, you know, obviously Trumbo and Wright is not going to be, a boost to them? Or is that not going to be as big of an issue as maybe some casual observers would think?
The Orioles defense will be one of the three best in the American League. When we can go around the positions, we can start with the idea of Wieters. If he's going to start the year, apparently on the DL, I guess it's still to be determined, the starting catcher becomes Joseph, if you believe in the metrics behind the plate with pitch framing, and obviously kind of everybody's coming closer to the mean at this point. But if you look at the numbers the last 2 years, he's been the superior defensive catcher than Wieters. Davis, certainly adequate at first. We talked about Scope at Scope and Hardy in the middle of the diamond. Obviously Machado at third. Rickard, he's going to be out there in left with said to have plus range. Trumbo will be an issue in right, but we'll see. We'll see how much that hurts the Orioles. They were able to get by with Cruz 2 years ago.
Sure.
And in center field, you have Adam Jones, who is kind of an interesting story in the fact that earlier in his career, he was probably getting too much praise for his defense, winning Gold Gloves. And if you looked at the metrics, I mean, they showed a guy that was a below-average center fielder. To me, I always was saying he was somewhere between those lows and the accolades he was getting. The last 2 years, the numbers have flipped, and he's been regarded, they have shown him to be above average. The only thing that apparently has really changed with Jones is his he's played a little bit deeper. So something interesting there to watch. To me, I still regard him the same, as I think he's not an elite center fielder, but above average.
Well, then, yeah, it seems like a defense that's well-positioned to take that gamble on Trumbo's offense, especially if everyone else around him is going to be a plus defender. So I think that'll work out in the end. One guy I want to ask you about, too, the closer, Zach Britton, turned in just an incredible year last year. You look at the numbers, tons of strikeouts, no walks, and then just an off-the-charts ground ball rate. Is there a chance he could be a sneaky, like the best closer in the American League, even with Craig Kimbrough coming over?
Sneaky only in the fact that he kind of remains an unknown, I think, outside of Baltimore.
Yeah, right.
His stuff is elite. It's not going to change. He's going to continue to throw. He's going to continue to get the high ground ball percentages, and I guess with more balls in play, that it has a chance for his numbers to be elevated at times. But in pure stuff, He compares to anybody, but there last year we saw an elevation in his strikeout rate as well. So, I think Britton's as good as anybody.
And the power sinker that he throws, that's the numbers say that's a swing and miss pitch. Is it what goes into that? What makes it such a great pitch that it's not only chopped into the ground, but guys just swing and miss at it? You know, most guys' fastballs, you know, they make plenty of contact on it.
Yeah, he does have. He just has a lot of movement with it as well. You just see, a lot of uncomfortable at bats. That's the best way to describe it. Is nobody. You don't see a lot of guys squaring up, and it just, you know, it comes in and it's grounded to short, grounded to third, grounded to second, and and that's it.
Yeah, I think that you know, the more we learn about the ground ball rates too, guys like this will be more and more appreciated, just because of I guess maybe there's not that much still to learn about ground ball rates, but at the same time too, is just you don't get too many extra base hits out of those, and so if you get into trouble, you can get a ground ball double play. You know, there's a lot of layers into it, and it's a very valuable guy to have at the back of your bullpen. As far as in the rotation, you know, we kind of tease this a little bit, but who do you suspect, you know, at the end of the year will be their most valuable starter?
Well, twofold. The most important starter is Gausman, and we've talked about why. It's about him reaching his ceiling. Beyond that, it's Tillman. Last year, again, he was just absolutely murdered by Toronto. Go back and look at the numbers. It just really inflated his numbers across the board. But it's a guy that doesn't have exceptional stuff. There's been some talk about effective velocity with Tillman, the fact that his release point, that he, you know, maybe gets a little extra tick in velocity there from just how far the extension is. Something interesting to look there. But, you know, overall, if you're looking at him and you'll see him opening day for, you know, Twins, it's a guy that just, he doesn't impress you a lot on the mound, but he's been, through 2012 through 2014, this guy that had about 72 starts of consistency of where you knew you were, what to expect start to start. And you'll see at the first inning against the Twins, something that really frustrates Oriole fans is in that first inning, you'll see a guy that sometimes he's at 86, 87 miles an hour before, like, a second inning kicks in and he winds up more in that 89 to 92 range. I don't know why that routinely happens, but it's something that's consistently happened over the last few years. But Tillman, his importance is really can't be understated, of being an anchor of a, you know, regularly taking the ball and giving the Orioles a chance to win.
And now, obviously, departing is Wei-Yin Chen, signed a big deal with the Marlins. And, you know, there was a lot of hand-wringing, I think, about if the team could bring him back. And so it seems to me, as an outside observer, that they are going to miss him somewhat significantly. What's your read on the situation? How much will they miss him as he acclimates to Miami and they move on as far as life after him?
Well, I mean, last year you had a below-average rotation, and the only starter that that performed with any consistency was Chen. So they're going to miss that, and he really had a nice run in his time with the Orioles. He provided good value back. He was also the lone lefty in the rotation. I don't know how much that really matters, but that's kind of a traditional argument. But and I think he'll have decent success with the Marlins. I didn't really want the Orioles to match the contract he got, but on the other hand, that kind of winds up being the going rate for a, you know, a third type starter on the free agent market. So there was an argument for his return, with a system devoid of talent that, you know, I'll take the extra pick, back in compensation. And while I'm not really excited about Gallardo again, I think Gallardo at least has a chance to match the innings void of Chen. And, you know, I don't think he'll be his equal, but if Tillman upticks and you get more out of Gausman. And we'll see what happens with the fifth starter. You have the chance to overcome that.
Yeah, it's not hard to imagine a situation where they can piece together value with other guys and kind of put it together. We have seen recently Hunter Harvey's battling kind of a groin issue, but are there any prospects you're keeping an eye on the farm for the Orioles, whether it's, you know, in the near term that could help the team, or in the long term are just higher end guys?
The two outside of Harvey, he was somebody wiped out last year, so you're just looking to get him back on a mound. There was some thought last year with Harvey that if he had been healthy, he probably could have ended the year with Double-A Bowie and been a potential guy to jump to the Orioles this year. So this year it's again about building back, getting some innings for him, and maybe at the end of the year maybe he's an option at some point, either the bullpen or as a spot starter. Beyond him, the two more interesting guys in the system are Cisco, catcher, and Omar Reyes, young guy, power guy, currently a third, probably going to have to move across the diamond in the first. It's a system devoid of a lot of talent. If you look at all of the, we talk about the organizational troubles that still exist. They don't do enough internationally. They don't add talent. On opening day, it'll be a good reminder to Oriole fans when they look across the diamond, they see the imposing Sano, somebody that they had some interest in but weren't willing to spend the dollars it took to obtain him. Well, you have to add some additional talent, and you can't just be relying on the draft alone. This June in the amateur draft, the Orioles do have a fair amount of picks within the top 100, and it's pretty imperative for the Orioles going forward that they land on a few.
All right, so we're going to put you on the record. What's your final prediction for how these Orioles will finish?
Yeah, I said 81 to 85 wins. I'll go on the high end of that. I'll say that I'm going to go into the year saying they're an 85 win team, which puts them on the outside of the second wild card, but it's certainly within reach of them to play up and be in that 88 to 92 win range. If they can be competitive up until the non-waiver deadline, I'm interested to see if they wind up looking to add another starter at that point. It's another season. Spring's here. I'm looking forward to another year of baseball. Let's get started. And like you said, the American League as a whole is going to be interesting as every team really looks at themselves as a competitor, and every division is pretty interesting.
Well, before I let you go, I got a couple quick lightning round questions for you. What was your take on the Maryland Terrapins NCAA run? Obviously made it two wins in before falling to top-seeded Kansas. No shame in losing to Kansas, but were you impressed with how they played down the stretch?
Maryland, 2002 national champs. After that, they got to the Sweet 16 the following year. And in the interim, they had not reached the Sweet 16 since then. So it was great to get back to that, but it was a year that started with Maryland being projected as a top three, top five team nationally. So to not be part of the Final Four is disappointing, even if this year was a step forward overall for the program.
What are your expectations for Mike Wallace? That's obviously a double-edged sword in this conversation as the Vikings fan here, losing Wallace and a Ravens fan gaining him. Do you suspect he can regain some of his magic with Joe Flacco, or do you think the tires don't have much tread left?
Nah, I'm not really sure what to expect from Wallace other than the fact that the Ravens they don't have a lot of playmakers on offense, and to give Flacco another deep threat is or another option, at least somebody that has a chance to perform, that's a worthwhile gamble to me for the cost that it was. Last year, the Ravens' first-round pick Perriman missed the entire season. He's another guy who's just going to be sent on go routes. So interested to see how they might mesh together. But putting them on opposing sides and forcing defenses to have to worry about receivers that can take the top off them, that's potentially interesting.
Minnesota angle here, too. What's been your read on Max Williams through one season in the NFL?
Max had a decent rookie season. Ravens, while they don't have a ton of playmakers, all of a sudden they have some depth at tight end with him, Crockett, Gilmore, and a recent free agent addition, Watson. Max has the opportunity to... And there are going to be a lot of two tight end sets for the Ravens, and he has a skill set that I don't see him being elite, but I see him being a consistent and consistently productive player.
And the last thing before I let you go, what are you expecting for the Ravens to do in the upcoming NFL draft?
Ravens are currently have the sixth spot at the site. We've had a lot of draft analysis from our guys. It looks like the most likely scenarios have them selecting a defensive player, maybe Jalen Ramsey or Buckner. Our current projection actually has Joey Bosa from Ohio State falling to the Ravens. What would be interesting to me is if they potentially trade back and gain an extra pick or so. Since they have multiple needs across the board, I could see them doing that with St. Louis being a potential trade partner.
Yeah, I think they're in a unique position to add a difference maker on defense if that's the angle they decide to go. And it looks like offensively, if they can get some guys to make some plays for them, which was obviously an issue last year, they could move forward pretty quickly. But I want to thank you for taking the time out to join us. This is, for people that are maybe just catching the end of this, Chris Stoner, who's in charge of Baltimore Sports and Life. Once again, thanks for coming on. Really enjoyed having you.
Hey, Brandon, I had a lot of fun. Again, thanks for the contributions you've made to the site. I've listened to a couple of the Cold Omaha podcasts. You guys have done a great job. Continued success there, and we'll talk soon.
Sounds great. Yeah, you've been listening to the Cold Omaha Midwest Swing Podcast. We do have a special edition coming tomorrow, joined by John Becker of Roster Resource, our second visit with Mr. Becker. So join us again tomorrow, and have a great day.
Coming soon to the Cold Omaha Podcast Network, Mike Talks Big. It's the name of the show, the name of the Facebook page and the Twitter account. Opinion-based Minnesota sports talk and entertainment, plus trending topics and the cool part. Credentialed writers in all the major locker rooms, professional and college, that will be on the show regularly. Mike Talks Big. It's the name of the Facebook page, the Twitter account, and the name of the show. Coming soon to the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
Hey, kiddies, it sucks that football season's over, but brand new, exciting development on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. New show, the Andy, Luke, and Rory Football Machine is kicking off. Pardon the pun. We got Luke Inman of eDraft. He's got his draft prowess and player development side. We got Arif Hassan of Everywhere. He's talking analytics and the thinking man side of the game. And we got me, Andy Carlson, who is also a person. Yeah. Show is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and of course, coldomaha.com/football machine, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network, baby. Let's go.
Hey guys, this is Tom Schreier, co-founder of coldomaha.com. Thank you for listening to the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and leave us a comment and a rating. Also, don't forget to check out coldomaha.com to see all of our podcasts and read articles about your favorite teams in the Twin Cities. If you have any suggestions or comments on anything related to Cold Omaha, email us at editors@coldomaha.com or follow us on Twitter @coldomahamn.
The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.